Up next, JX assistant producer Maddie Peterson offers a selection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Maddie Peterson. Climatologists are predicting an active fire season after a dry winter. Firefighters around the West are standing ready. That includes smoke jumpers, who parachute out of planes to fight fire deep in the backcountry. JPR's Justin Higginbottom visited California's only smoke jumper base.
At the Redding Smoke Jumper Base, footage from April shows new cadets jumping off a training tower, whizzing down a zipline. This spring, 12 cadets began a six-week program to become smoke jumpers. They faced grueling physical and mental tests, and if they pass, they get to jump out of airplanes, hike through miles of backcountry, and fight fire. The job tends to attract a certain type, like Brandon Sweezy. He learned about smoke jumpers his first day on a fire engine crew.
I mean, it just seemed like the coolest job there was, man. The lure of it, the tradition.
And it turns out, for him, it is the coolest job there is. He remembers his first jump.
It was wild. I mean, you're in the plane with your rookie bros that you've been, you know, going through all this for a couple weeks with.
He watched his rookie bros one by one jump out.
It makes this loud, like, whoosh sound, and it kind of hits you like, oh, man, you know, like, I'm going next.
He tried to remember his training, weeks of exhausting work, all building up to this point.
Out you go, and next thing you know, you're on the ground, and you got a big adrenaline dump, and it's pretty cool.
Sweezy figured becoming a smoke jumper would be hard, but there's some things about the job that he wasn't expecting, like how learning to climb up and down trees is just as important as jumping out of planes. He remembers this jump on a windy day as a rookie.
I was so focused on this one tree, making it over that, and I flew over it, kind of clipped it with my feet, that I didn't see the tree in front of me.
Luckily, he wasn't injured, and he rappelled down. But it's not only smoke jumpers that get caught up in trees. Planes drop supplies during an operation. Those cargo boxes regularly end up in the forest canopy. Smoke jumpers become such skilled arborists that they get called to remove tree limbs and other hazards at campsites in winter. Another thing Sweezy didn't realize is that he would need to learn how to sew. Inside what they call the loft are rows of sewing machines. Matthew West, assistant operations manager at the base, is sitting at one. Smoke jumpers manufacture their entire jumpsuit. West says there's a couple reasons for that.
Well, it's cost effective and it's pretty unique. So there's nobody else that parachutes into wildfires.
They're also constantly repairing their gear, which can take a beating. West has been a smoke jumper for 13 years. He says one of the biggest changes he's seen during that time is the type of parachute they use. Smoke jumpers transitioned from a round, old army style to what's called a ram air parachute. Those are the rectangle-shaped, highly maneuverable parachutes you'd see in the sports world. Smoke jumping began in 1940. This Redding base has been operating since 1957. Although some things have changed over the years, the philosophy of smoke jumping has pretty much stayed the same.
Our policy in our forest is that when there's a fire that breaks out, you go get it.
That's Bob Doucette, a public affairs officer for the Forest Service. After decades of experience, smoke jumpers understand more about fire science and how to keep people safe.
You're always trying to account for looking out for communities, looking out for the resources that are out there, but also safety. You know, you're not going to have like a massive fire and then send people headlong right into it. You got to be safe about how you attack it.
Out on the runway, a short C-23 Sherpa sits packed and ready. That's an old military transport plane.
We got our saw boxes there, we got chainsaws, chaps.
Inside, there's cargo ready to be dropped along with the smoke jumpers, enough for them to be self-sufficient for 72 hours. Last year, Redding smoke jumpers jumped 59 fires across the region. Wes says the hardest part of the job are these operations during the fire season. But surprisingly, he doesn't mean the jumping out of planes and firefighting part. It's being away from family and loved ones. Smoke jumpers can be on fire for weeks.
Once fires start happening, you're going to be spending very limited amount of days or time at all at home with your family. And I think that's the most challenging part for me, and I think the thing that I see is the most challenging for everybody once you get established in your career.
Again, the job's not for everyone. Sweezy, the new smoke jumper, said only half of his class made it through the training.
I think if anyone shows up kind of one foot in, one foot out, they'll kind of get weeded out quick. You kind of got to be all in.
For him, it's both feet forward, like jumping out of a plane. Justin Higginbottom, JPR News.
After 15 years, a major conservation project near the town of Florence has achieved its goal, connecting a large swath of restored farmland to the Oregon coast. The Siuslaw Estuary is a 217-acre expanse that's expected to accommodate the return of salmon, lamprey, shorebirds, and native plants as it transforms with the tides. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
It was a cool, misty morning at the estuary. Excavators and dump trucks hustled around an earthen levee that held the Siuslaw River back from a site that used to be a dairy farm called the Waite Ranch. Wearing a hard hat and reflective vest, Dan Kirk walked through the dewy brush and reddish mud, waving a smoking bundle of sage.
I've been blessing the site almost daily. We really care about this project and just putting as much intention and good thoughts and good feelings and gratitude as much as we can.
Kirk is the restoration project's manager for the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. Other tribal members, as well as partner organizations for the estuary project, were gathered nearby to witness something historic.
Today we will be reconnecting the tidal Siuslaw River into the site, so creating about 180 acres of new wetland that was historically tidal wetland before the mid-1800s when it became a dairy farm.
Margaret Treadwell, the Central Coast Conservation Manager for the Mackenzie River Trust, stood by as a towering excavator crawled towards the levee.
It's really exciting. I have never seen a levee breach before.
As the crowd watched, the excavator extended its toothy bucket and tore down a chunk of the levee. River water surged in immediately as people cheered.
Keep an eye out for animals coming back in. Apparently, when these breaches happen, the animals figure it out very quickly.
What kind of animals should we keep an eye out for?
Well, fish, birds, and who knows, maybe a seal.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
The estuary began to fill with water it hadn't contacted with for a century and a half. Chief Doug Barrett of the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians looked at the reformed farmland, which includes a 1.2-mile-long berm that's 12 feet high and protects Highway 126. With the project coming to roughly $15 million and the development nearly 3 years to complete, Barrett was happy to have witnessed the historic breach.
I kind of got goosebumps. It's been a long time coming.
The tribe sees this as a place to gather and practice traditions, as the salinity of the estuary will develop new plant and animal life. Barrett shared its new name.
Now it's called Haichiktatu. Haichiktatu is the heart of the river. And so this is a pretty awesome place now to call our home. Just awesome to see the water coming in, knowing that the salmon and lamprey could come in here and hide from all of our predators. It's a pretty good feeling.
Roughly 4 hours later, a contingent of tribal council members arrived in Lati, a 32-foot-long dugout canoe carved from western red cedar. They paddled in from the port of Siuslaw, nearly 4 miles away. After crossing through the mouth of the newly opened channel, the group sprinkled tobacco and tule seeds into the water. Jesse Beers, the cultural stewardship manager for the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians, lowered the remains of a salmon into the brackish currents.
When we were in the channel there, almost brought tears to my eyes, returned some salmon remains to let the salmon people know that it's a good place to come again and fatten up and be healthy, and it's just an amazing experience.
Besides the tribes and Mackenzie River Trust, the Siuslaw Watershed Council is another partner. Its restoration project manager, Mizu Burris, said partnerships like these are essential due to the financial and logistical challenges a lone organization would face.
And they not only are they essential to making them happen, but they make them richer, better, more complex and diverse projects, which when we're talking about ecosystem restoration, that's what we want.
By midday, the Siuslaw estuary was submerged with brackish water as cormorants and swallows swooped overhead. Chief Doug Barrett looked out at the expanse.
It's great to see the water coming in. It'll come in all day from now on, hopefully till the end of time.
I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Florence.
Scientists and students are making the most of a funding delay affecting the Packwave project off the Oregon coast. KLCC's Brianna Bowman reports on the water from the Pacific storm.
On a cool and still May morning, biology students from Oregon Coast Community College walked past the familiar chorus of sea lions on Newport's bayfront and boarded OSU's 84-foot research vessel.
All right, good morning, everybody. My name's Kevin. I'm going to be your captain today.
This field trip is part of Oregon Sea Grant's STEM at Sea program, which gives rural high school and community college classes the opportunity to go to sea with scientists. Tracy Cruz with Oregon Sea Grant says they'll get to be part of the action as members of the science party for a day.
They will be out there helping to collect the data and sort through the samples, and so it's really that hands-on component.
On this particular day, students helped collect seafloor sediment samples at the Packwave South site, located about 7 miles offshore directly west of Newport. Packwave is a unique wave energy converter testing project. In 2024, 4 cables were buried in the seafloor sediment stretching from the facility in Waldport to the Packwave site. No converters are currently installed due to a lack of funding flowing to developers from the U.S. Department of Energy. That isn't stopping researchers. Sarah Henkel is an associate professor in the Integrative Biology Department at OSU. She's tasked with monitoring the potential impacts of installing the cables and other project infrastructure on the seafloor ecology.
I have been taking seafloor samples of the site and the surrounding areas since 2013. And now we are doing our post-installation sampling to see if we can detect any changes from the physical installation of the cables.
On deck, over the hum of the Pacific Storm's diesel engine, Henkel gave a briefing about what the class was going to be doing as a part of the scientific crew that day.
A sample of sediment off the top in a small jar, and we will use that, take that back to the lab, and measure the grain size of the sediment. And then there will be a bucket underneath.
Henkel noted that the very thing that makes Packwave a great location for this kind of testing, large, energetic ocean waves, also means the seabed is used to a highly dynamic environment.
Any sediment disturbance that might have happened from digging the trench and then pushing the sediment back in is probably on the scale of what these seafloor critters experience with a winter storm.
While this type of sampling requires a large vessel to deploy the sediment-grabbing device, known as the box corer, the process itself is relatively straightforward, making it an ideal hands-on introduction to the world of marine science for students.
Who was it?
Got it.
Hunched over the sieve in groups of 3 or 4, they used forceps to break apart chunks of clay and mud. Henkel is fascinated by the variety of sediment she finds in this area.
You know, if you garden here on the coast in your yard, you've probably got one patch that's like perfect soil, and then you're like, there's all this clay and gravel, like, you know, just a couple paces away in your yard. And so you gotta remember, like, it's the same thing out here, right? It's just a continuation of the land.
The students carefully looked for anything that might be alive, had once been alive, or might contain life, like a shell. Some creatures, such as bright red worms, stood out immediately. Others, like teeny tiny clamshells, were easy to overlook at first, but before long, the students' eyes became trained to spot them. But that wasn't all the students saw. Selena Harris had her first experience ever seeing a whale.
When I saw it, my jaw just dropped to the floor. Like, it's just, you know, I'm one of those people that's a thrill junkie. But, you know, roller coaster could not ever amount to seeing a whale in the wild.
The crew collected 15 samples over the course of the day. Instructor Sam Loftus noted the importance of giving students these kinds of hands-on opportunities.
And part of why I think coming out on these trips is really important for them is somebody on this boat today might be a worm ecologist and didn't know it until today.
What did we find in here?
Couple of brittle stars and sea cucumbers.
On the way back to port, there was a sense of relief for some as the ship returned to calmer waters. Some of these students were happy to be back on land, but for others, this might just be the start of a passion for ocean science. In Newport, I'm Brianna Bowman reporting.
That's it for today's exchange. I'm Mike Green. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more, or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.